come here and just talk a little bit about kind of networking and interacting between students and professionals, which we really strive to do in our organization, and also to talk a little bit about our careers, our backgrounds, and kind of give you a sense of the wide range of professional jobs that you can take in the field. So I'm going to first give you a little bit of background on AWRA, the organization. We're a multidisciplinary organization, much like the Water Center, where we strive to bring together sort of diverse disciplines related to water management and really connect, have dialogue, and provide a forum where all points of views and different disciplines' perspectives can be lent on particular issues. We're made up of engineers, geologists, biologists, attorneys, policy and planning folks like myself. And we host a number of events around the Seattle area and around the state where we bring technical speakers, and we have a discussion on a particular topic. We host conferences. We also interact with the student chapter of the American Water Resources Association here at the UW as well, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. I want to introduce the four panel members. You heard about me. Sitting to my left here is Beth Peterson. She's one of our board of directors, and she is an engineer with HDR Engineering and has been working a lot on mitigation planning and wetland restoration, and hopefully she'll touch upon that. Cleve Stewart is our past president of the American Water Resources Association Washington chapter, and he's a fisheries scientist with AMEC, and I don't know what that stands for. So.
It's new.
It's a yeah.
And then finally, Pete Sturdivant is also a member of our board of directors. He's a past president of our organization, has been very active, has a long history of working with our organization and professionally here in the field. Pete is a civil engineer with CH2M Hill. So I think, Beth, if you want to kind of kick it off and start a little bit about sort of your career, education, what you're doing now, that'd be great.
My education background, I got a BS in engineering science at Trinity University in San Antonio, and this degree is a little different. It's ABET accredited, but it focuses really on chemical, electrical, and mechanical engineering. So I took a lot of different classes in chemical and environmental, and then went on to get a master's at University of California, Berkeley, in the civil and environmental engineering program, specializing in water resources, where I did a lot of limnology, hydrology, and then my research was on a constructed wetland for stormwater treatment. The first job I took was at an engineering consulting firm called SEH. It's based out of Minneapolis. So then I moved back to Minneapolis and worked there for about 5 years, kind of working up through the ranks, doing a lot of just staff engineering. It was stormwater planning and design. Starting to get a little bit, using my research and do a little bit more wetland design, but not so much. At that time, it was the lake studies, water quality monitoring. And then about 4+ years ago, I moved out to Seattle and took a job at HDR. And right currently, I'm doing more project management, task leads for large projects, doing still some stormwater planning, municipal planning, like stormwater comp plans for cities where you're looking at the city's facilities, looking at inadequacies in the systems, and developing CIPs. That's one project I'm working on now. Other leading drainage design, stormwater design for large projects, and then, as Jack indicated, doing a lot of more wetland mitigation and restoration projects. One project I finished, and I know it's been discussed in certain classes here, is the Springbrook Creek Wetland and Habitat Mitigation Bank that was done with the DOT. It was the first bank permitted in an urban environment in the state of Washington. And so that's under construction now, should finish this year. So that's kind of what I do now. So it says doing still some design, but a lot more kind of shift kind of gears into project management, so leading the staff and projects to complete the task. Skills to succeed in the field was one thing we wanted to talk about. As I indicated, I went to a smaller school called an engineering science degree. And one thing I really liked about going to a liberal arts school is it really focused on design projects, working with teams, public speaking, and writing. And all of you here probably have a technical background and technical skills, but when you get out in the working world, it's really important to be able to communicate what you're doing, the results, and working with teams. That becomes a really important part of your job, whether you're managing projects, whether you're a staff on a project. Communicating what you're doing, getting your point across, getting the results across is really important, both speaking and writing. And you probably won't get away from that in your career. Thoughts on where the future of the field is heading? There are kind of buzzwords you get out in the field. One I hear a lot is climate change and how it's going to affect what we're doing. Say we're doing hydrology modeling and we're looking at systems. Is climate change, like say for the city municipal planning, how do we incorporate climate change in the future, and are things really changing, and do we need to look at design storms? Another one is low impact design and natural drainage practices is another buzzword out there. A lot of the traditional best management practices used for stormwater treatment are detention ponds, maybe sometimes constructed wetlands, but we're looking at a lot of like amended soils, vegetation for sedimentation, a lot of these natural drainage practices to provide water quality treatment or flow control, and I see that kind of budding out in a lot of projects, and people are definitely interested as you go in looking at new projects that they want to incorporate as much of that as possible. So those are just some of my thoughts.
Now I have a question before I launch into sort of my overview of where things are headed. Are we going to ask the audience to pose questions?
Yes.
At the end or following each speaker?
Yeah, we can do it right now if folks, if you have questions on anything as we speak. This is a pretty informal kind of panel discussion, so feel free to raise your hand and we can address them now. Otherwise, we'll make sure we have some time at the end to...
Okay, yeah. So... I come from a slightly different background than most of the folks involved with AWRA. I'm a fisheries biologist, and I got my master's here at the UW. I've lived in this area for the past 17 years, part of which I work for the National Marine Fisheries Service over here at the Northwest Science Center, but mostly as a consultant, as the owner of my own consulting firm called Stewart & Associates. And we were fairly small. It grew to 10 over the years, over the 15 or so years that we were in business. And then last year, I was approached by a large consulting firm that wanted to add to their fisheries expertise. They basically had a hole in their firm, and they wanted to fill it. And so they came to me. I'd been approached by other firms in the past, but either the culture wasn't right or the money wasn't right. And so I listened to this with some skepticism, but they made good on their offer. And more importantly, they're allowing us to pursue the types of projects that we're good at and we feel are important. We're driven by a strong conservation ethic. We're very much involved in salmon recovery, as is virtually everybody that's involved with salmon at all these days. But we've been involved, I personally, from the outset. I was one of the co-signers on the petition to list Snake River Chinook back in the early 90s, which sort of stirred the pot and got subsequently all the other species listed. So I've watched this. There have been a couple of milestones. Not that I claim credit for any of this, but I've sort of been on board, and over the course of my career, I've watched fisheries management go through a major paradigm shift from one where we were supporting the fisheries. We were meant to get fish in the net or on the hook. That was our raison d'etre. But we've switched to trying to preserve stocks and avoid extinction. So our whole purpose has gone over towards salmon recovery. And that's a good thing because salmon are definitely in need of recovery. I mean, of the 400 some individual stocks in Washington State, fully half are listed as depressed, based on stock productivity indices. And so our work has focused on evaluating the status and trend of these fish and prescribing measures, whether it's habitat restoration or preventing adverse impacts from hydro operations, just the whole gamut of things that have contributed to the decline of the stocks we're trying to reverse. And as far as what the future portends, I would say it's more of the same. And I try to look at this in a optimistic way because it's easy to sort of get depressed about it. because the overall underlying root causes aren't going to go away. And those include population, human population growth. We're going to see a doubling or quadrupling, mainly through immigration into this area, of the number of people living in this region over the next 50 years. I mean, I think that's pretty much inescapable. We're going to continue to see, let's call them competing priorities that take precedence over salmon recovery. I think most of us value salmon. It represents something iconic and important to us. But when it comes down to a choice, there are other things that are appealing that, if not incompatible, they make salmon recovery that much more difficult. And then we're facing globalization of the world economy, where the decisions that are made in the name of economic efficiency or gain are disconnected from sort of their ecological impacts. They're happening somewhere way overseas, and they're irrelevant to the policy decisions that we make here. That's as opposed in the extreme example of the tight feedback loop that exists between Aboriginal fishers and the resource. I mention this because I work with a lot of tribes, and they still, although you think of them as running casinos and, you know, players in the local economy, they still have a very strong spiritual connection to the fish, because their livelihood, their ecology really was intertwined deeply with the fish. So I'm exposed to that. It resonates well with me, because I come from a sort of an outdoors background. But is that going to continue into the future? Or do we see more and more attitudes and behaviors that are driven by, you know, whatever it is that we need for our own personal satisfaction and well-being? And it may not include or give as much emphasis to the sort of ecological values as it has in the past. So there are these underlying sort of core drivers of who we are as a society, and consequently the challenges, resource challenges that we face. But I guess I'll wrap up by saying it's all inextricably bound with water. I mean, from a technological standpoint, we could probably solve the problem of water quality more so than water supply, more easily than water supply, but both of those are much easier to solve than is salmon recovery, which of course involves a complex system that involves the fish, marine, and freshwater habitats. So as somebody whose livelihood and the resource for which I work, the fish, is definitely affected by water resources, it's important for me to stay in the game when it comes to water management. So I'm willing to take any questions. I also want to mention that my current company, AMAC Earth and Environmental, does accept interns during the summer. So I'm not telling you got to come talk to me, but if you're interested, this is a good way to break into the field. In our company, we always took interns and we paid them. And invariably, those same people either came back to work for us or they went on to graduate school in the same field. And so just as a stratagem, I think you want to look at ways of deepening your knowledge and connections with the professional field out there, whether it's in the public sector or the private.
Okay, go ahead. I'm Pete Sturdivant. I've been working in the water resources field for something over 30 years now. Did my undergraduate work at the University of California at San Diego, and came up here at the University of Washington, got my master's degree in water resources at Moore Hall, just a couple hundred yards down the road from here. Been a lifelong Husky fan, and even fished out my purple tie here for the event. Any excuse to get on the dance, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm real happy to be here. Tell me, is this mostly a class of graduate students? Any undergrads here? Okay, that'll play in a little bit of what I present. When I first started in the field of water resources, by the way, my career has been primarily with consulting firms as well. We only really have one agency person here today, but I guess that's just the way the cards fell, who could get off work today. But when I started in the field, the primary emphasis in water resources, at least in this country, the Clean Water Act had been passed in 72, and by the mid-70s, there were billions of dollars available through EPA for upgrading sewer treatment plants. And so there's a big push on what they call 201 studies and then treatment plant upgrades. At the same time, EPA was just getting involved, heavily involved with permitting on the industrial side and all the industrial discharges. So probably from the early 70s through the early 90s, the emphasis in the water resources field, at least as far as water quality was concerned, was end-of-pipe treatment, get the big discharges, the heavy polluters under control and treatment going. And they've largely succeeded in doing that. In the past 15 years or so, the emphasis in the water quality field has shifted toward the much more diffuse and difficult to solve non-point sources, runoff from urban landscapes, farmland, silviculture, and the like. And I'd have to say much of my work in recent decade or two has been focused more toward that aspect. We're very fortunate here in the Northwest, and particularly in the Seattle area, Seattle and Puget Sound, Western Washington, pretty much led the nation in terms of development awareness of the impact, serious impacts of urban runoff and the effects it has on streams. And this was largely driven by the urgent desire that the state has had for probably 20 years or more now to try and reverse the trend of declining salmon and fish populations and to restore fish populations. And one of the big drivers that has caused the fish problems, other than overfishing and a few dozen other problems, is the local impacts that urban runoff has had on degrading streams. And so the state of Washington, very early on in the early 90s, developed some of the first specific regulations for controlling runoff in cities like Bellevue and King County, led the way in terms of local ordinances that were adopted to enforce better development, detention and stormwater treatment, better control of stormwater. And so this has been a field that has been very active and very lucrative for people coming out of school and going into the profession. Stormwater control, erosion control, and that sort of thing. It sounds somewhat mundane. There are fascinating aspects to it, and certainly is a very necessary part of the overall approach to water resources to hold the line and hopefully even reverse some of the quality and stream degradation that we've seen through unmanaged stormwater controls. So one of the aspects, I think, in the field that's probably as lucrative as any in water resources is the more applied, hands-on type of expertise, the engineering. Degree in hydrology or emphasis in hydraulics, drainage control, is a good solid background to have. If not to go into that profession, it certainly gives you a better understanding of problems that you'll undoubtedly be faced with in your career in water resources. So from my own development, my own personal career, my undergraduate degree was in biology, and I had a kind of medium soft to hardcore graduate education, but by no means was I a formally trained engineer. That occurred during my years with consulting firms, kind of by osmosis, and eventually I got my professional engineer's license about halfway through my career. And so I guess what I'm saying is, for those of you that are so inclined, an engineering, if not an engineering degree, certainly eventually working toward an engineering license is something that I think will give you a great degree of flexibility, both in the types of work you do and in the places and in the type of career you have. So that may be some food for thought. Another idea is that, at least in the private sector, and I'm sure it's probably true in the public sector as well, how do you build a good resume if you're interested in going in that direction? Well, I have a couple of ideas I'd like to share, things that I look at when I'm looking at resumes for a prospective job opening. One of them, for graduate students, of course, you've got the advantage of either master's thesis or PhD, so you've automatically got a really strong technical talking point when you go into an interview. But for undergrads, I very much would recommend, if you're not going to meet beyond to get a graduate degree, that you do some sort of a senior project. that gives you a strong technical talking point coming into an interview. And I know I personally am always more impressed with someone that has done some level of research and formal writing as a distinguishing factor from all the resumes that I may see in a given month or a given year for a job position. Any other words of wisdom? Writing. I remember as a sophomore and freshman at my undergraduate course, we went through a strict requirement of 6 quarters of humanities classes, each of which required 3 10-page papers. So 18 papers over the course, 18 papers over the course of the first 2 years. And how I cursed that, 3 times a quarter, I'd have to come up with a new idea and a 10-page paper. Well, I'd have to say that was probably the single most valuable piece of college education that I got, the ability to write and write clearly. Virtually any profession that you go in is going to put a premium on that. Now, there are people, particularly in the engineering profession, that are very good at analytical and calculations and engineering aspects. But sooner or later in their career, if you want to rise beyond just being a technician or, you know, an entry to mid-level engineer, writing is very important. And so take advantage of classes that you can do that, perhaps out of the engineering or out of the sciences. Humanities classes that hone those writing skills will do you justice in the future.
Actually, I wanted to echo that. I've hired dozens of people or interviewed many more, actually. I place a very high premium on writing because I've gone through the experience of getting something that doesn't clearly communicate what the intent is of the writer. And if I get something like that, I know full well that the intended audience isn't going to be impressed. That'll basically hinder comprehension and make it less likely that they're going to do what we are recommending. And we're in the business of providing advice. And just from a personal standpoint, I don't want to be in a position to get something from one of my employees that I have to turn around and rewrite because they didn't make the effort or they really didn't marshal the facts and put them in a compelling order so that you could logically progress and follow their train of thought and arrive at the same conclusion that they did. It's very important. I think I'm not unlike a lot of employers in emphasizing that. And the good news is we're all latent writers. I mean, budding writers in that. If you aren't good now, you can get good with practice. I mean, everybody improves over time as long as they apply themselves. And so a lot of times I'll hire somebody. First thing I'll hand them is this a writing style guidebook or just something that helps them understand that, you know, the expectation is there that they'll improve. I don't expect a masterpiece at the outset, but they have to apply themselves. And so just take it upon yourselves to improve in that area. Because like Pete says, it's all about communicating. And you aren't going to get very far if you can't win people over to your point of view or understand theirs. So that's okay. Number one.
Yeah. And some other things I may look at differentiators. Once again, a lot of good people out there. There's lots of jobs these days, and I'll get to that in the concluding part of my talk. But other differentiators I look for prospective applicants and people working in our group. Membership in some sort of a professional or society, university society, active membership is another differentiator, particularly if it's been some sort of leadership position, an executive president or secretary or some active position. Does well on your resume and is definitely worth the effort to joining, in addition to the knowledge you gain by being active in that during your college career. Another aspect that a differentiator we look at is just any job experience. Part-time internship, as Cleve was saying, or working a summer job in the profession is a very good differentiator. It indicates a strong active interest on the part of the applicant and gives the person like me more confidence that the person coming into the job will require less training and get the job running. So I'd say writing skills first and foremost, some sort of a dissertation or senior thesis is a good thing. Society membership and part-time work in the profession are all things that serve you well as you go out into the job market and looking for your first or second job. Now, my kind of perspective in the water resources career in general, from the time I entered it, in fact, before I entered it, back in the early 70s, there was talk about the impending water crisis and then the fact that water resources were limited and were would run out, and a great need for people in the industry. I have to say, over my 30-plus year term in the profession, if anything, that's only intensified. There are a lot more people in the profession, but the problems have spread. If due to water quality degradation, certainly the Southwest has always been an area with water shortages, but I've seen it now actively ongoing water crisis spread to the southeast of the United States. Up here, we don't tend to have water supply crises so much, but certainly our fish-driven rivers and hydrology, in effect, makes water relatively limited for other uses. There's been no open water rights, surface water rights in the state of Washington for over a decade, in the western part of the state, for over a decade because of other needs, in-stream needs. So the profession is still as robust and as much opportunity as when I entered it 30 years ago, or I would say even more so. I can tell you from personal experience, once again, particularly in the harder, more specific disciplines such as modeling, surface water hydrology, or water supply engineering, we're my firm's looking, actively looking for engineers in that kind of profession. And certainly in the broader sciences, there's a continuing need, both in the public sector and the private sector, for good trained scientists dealing with streams, groundwater, and habitat, and the like. So you're in a good profession. Stay with it.
All right. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about, I think listening, I remember as an undergrad, when I graduated from college, I went to Duke University, and I got a bachelor's in environmental science and policy, and I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do upon graduation, and took a job out here in Washington State, moved from North Carolina here, and I worked at Hanford working on environmental restoration work in Eastern Washington, and kind of did that a little bit. But really what I had a science background, but what I was really interested in was that, most of the environmental problems that we face in the water arena especially, and environmental problems in general, really boils down to people and getting people to make behavioral changes. And so what I was most interested in is sort of dealing with the people side. And so I actually went back to graduate school here at the University of Washington in the College of Forestry Sources and studied policy and planning under Claire Ryan, who's actually here, I believe. So I was also funded with the Water Center, which was, when I was here, was the Center for Streamside Studies. So I'm a proud alumnus of the now Water Center, and also living proof that you can go here, get a degree, and get a job in your field. So that's always good to know as well. So my graduate research was on water policy and planning and sort of collaborative planning between the different players to develop water management plans in the state. And I actually was able to parlay that research into a job, and I went to work for the Department of Ecology, and I worked initially on water right permits. So I was reviewing water supply plans and determining if water was available for different water projects. I also dipped my toes a little bit in enforcement of water laws as well, but primarily on the water quantity side. Over time, I shifted more into planning and policy work. I've written policies and laws on water management related to flows for salmon and for water supply for people and for farms. I also act as a planner and kind of a liaison to local communities to develop water management plans and really represent the state of Washington in negotiations and discussions about how best to manage our water resources. That's kind of what I'm doing right now. And I really would echo some of the same things that have been said about, you know, you can't overestimate just the need to communicate. I think a lot of the problems, you know, it all boils down to relationships and being able to work with people. Sometimes, you know, the technical problems really are not the most challenging. It's really the people problems. It's the relationship issue of trying to, you know, get different organizations that have been fighting, have years of history of bad blood and bad history, trying to get them to shift gears and to collaborate and to work. That usually is far more difficult to do. And I think, you know, in retrospect, like, maybe I should have gotten a degree in part psychology and theology and science to kind of to understand how people view the world and you know, how we can best communicate and work together. I think also the analytical skills of being able to sort of digest different technical aspects of a problem, be it, you know, hydrology, be it geology or biology, law. You have to kind of bring that diverse, you know, all these different factors come into play when you're trying to solve a water issue. And so I think, you know, a lot of that is fostered in part, you know, I think through the center, coming to lectures like this, learning about different aspects of water management, how, you know, different folks perceive an issue. It's really important to be able to use that, and I use those skills every day. It's really essential to getting work done, and I think all three of them would echo that as well. In terms of where the future is going, you know, I think in the course of, I graduated in 2001 from here, and that's been 7 years ago, and it's doesn't seem right, but there's a whole, as I was driving here, I'm like, I don't recognize some of these buildings. So I'm feeling a little old. You know, the technology, GIS, remote sensing, you know, these have really changed water management fundamentally in the last 7 years that I've been working in the field, and I really see that just the uses and application, we're really getting into a much greater, you know, data management field, and those skills are really essential to being able to manage water and deal with other environmental issues. I also see kind of a greater emphasis of solving environmental issues at the state and local level. We're seeing a lot of, I think, sort of a de-emphasis of the federal government driving policy. So it's sort of a really neat thing of working at the you know, local and state level to be, you know, we're really in the forefront of dealing with, in particular, the western states, you know, are really driving a lot of the climate change stuff and action that we're taking. We've teamed up with Washington, or with Oregon and California and Arizona and some other western states to think about, you know, how we can best address climate change. That's one example. But there's really going, we're seeing, and Pete touched upon it, about, you know, stormwater management really was driven a lot at the local and state level, and so I think that's a trend that's going to continue as well. Looks like we're getting a little close to the time, but I'll finally touch upon, you know, the great thing about working for a public agency and being a public servant is that, you know, we work for the public, and so that's the, you know, includes the diversity of a range of ideas, and I found it to be an incredibly great place to do technical work. It's very rewarding because, you know, we're not hired by one client with one particular viewpoint. You know, we have to sort of take the technical information and sort of view it in the lens of the law and the public's interest, and that's, you know, wide-ranging interest from, you know, environmental interest to economic development interest. And it's a really challenging and fun job, and every day, you know, I really just feel pretty energized and lucky to be able to represent the public, and so I would give that plug for public sector work. It can be really rewarding in that aspect. So finally, I think we'll just wrap up a little bit to talk about the American Water Resources Association, and especially the student chapter that we are affiliated with. We're affiliated with the American Water Resources Association, which is a national organization, and this is just a couple of their, they publish this technical journal that, you know, if you're a graduate or undergraduate student, you know, like to get your peer-reviewed paper in there. And they also publish this journal as well, which is a more of a, I think it's not as, you know, it's not peer-reviewed, but it's really interesting. They always focus on a particular topical issue as well. They host conferences, and they're, you know, a really great organization that brings together diverse disciplines. Our state chapter is a separate chapter. We're affiliated with the AWRA National, but really, you know, we focus on regional and local issues and fostering connections and community with folks at the local level. This University of Washington has a student chapter, and I see at least one of the members, her, Amy, you wanna, and Julie are here. You want to raise your hands? So there are a few of the folks that are affiliated with the chapter and have been served in leadership positions. You know, it's a great student organization, and we try to help support this organization as much as possible. We provide one scholarship annually to a member of the UW student chapter, and that helps. I'm sure that the cost of tuition has far outpaced our scholarship, but the nice thing about our scholarship is that there's no particular restrictions on it, so you can use it. You know, we cut you a check once we award it, and so if you wanted to use it for equipment, if you want to use it to pay for tuition, cost of living expenses, to register for a conference and pay for your travel expenses, you can do that. So it's really just a great opportunity. It's a really easy application, and we set out the announcements in the fall of each year and award them in the fall. We also, the student chapter, so that's one way that we support them. They also host a number of events and try just to bring together students from the different academic disciplines here. And I know they've organized some great, you know, restoration work parties. They did a Skagit River float trip and brought in some folks from our organization and technical folks in the basin to talk about some of the water management issues there. They organized a tour of the Elwha Dam removal. I think that was a camp out two-day thing, and were able to bring in the different technical experts to talk about the different parts about that challenging project. So those are a few of the things that they do, and I know they also just have monthly meetings probably to just you know, make connections between the different disciplines. So it's a great organization, and I really encourage you to get involved with them, and it always helps just, you know, I guess Pete, you heard Pete say that's one thing that he would look on a resume for, but it really helps to, you know, make, forge those connections between different disciplines. So I think that's kind of what I wanted to touch upon about, you know, our organization. This is a really informal little panel. We just wanted to talk a little bit about our careers and how we got to it, and hopefully you'll have some questions for us that we can answer, and folks, if you have anything else to add, panel members, feel free.
Just a real quick plug. I'm a member of another organization, Engineers Without Borders, and I just want to mention the national conference is going to be held on this campus in about 2 months, the last weekend of March. So if you're interested and heard of that organization, the whole shebang is going to be here at the end of March.
I wanted to mention also that the student award that we give every year includes free registration for both the state and the national AWRA meeting. So there's quite a bit of value, along with the intangibles of, you know, hanging with us. But we like our students, and that's where we all started. And so it's a great way for networking, coming to the student chapter sponsored meetings, but also participating on the committees and planning activities and all the things that we do at the state section. And you're more likely than not to, you know, be taken under somebody's wing or, you know, dumped on, had a lot of stuff given to you. And if you can perform and interact with people in that way, you'll get noticed. So that's a great way. And just in general, membership and participation, active participation in your professional societies is very important. Not only does it bring you in contact with people, but it gives you a vehicle or a mode of expressing your interests, the things that motivate you. And we're all value-driven. I mean, we aren't just scientists off doing our thing value-neutral. It's important that we bring through and discuss with our colleagues what our own personal preferences and ethics are. Because at the root of all this, you know, good education, sound principles, enthusiasm for what you're doing, communication, all that is what makes you successful as a professional.
Any questions out there? What it's like beyond the hallowed halls of UW.
Any fisheries people here? Great.
How many of you will be graduating or going into a profession this year? Still a fair number of you with some years left to go.
Do you feel, based on what we've said, that your education is preparing you for life in the real world? Or are you just kind of following, you know, the directions that you're given without any expectations of what you'll be doing?
Well, hopefully they're going to some branch.
I mean, we're all kind of naive as we go through this, just hoping for the best. But
we expect to train new staff. I mean, let's not forget that. Like, when you come fresh out of school, we don't expect you to know everything, and we hand you things and run. We expect to spend some time with you, getting you up to speed.
And I'm living proof that you don't really need a whole lot of, like, a great plan. And I'm going to make a plug for sort of the general educational background, not the engineering thing. You can go far with you can go really far in your career. And I think it's really important to be able to have kind of a diverse set of skills, technical skills. We're kind of heavy on the engineering folks here, but and that's important. And it's certainly a very lucrative part of the water resource professional pie. But if you're interested in other aspects, you can do great things with it and go pretty far.
One thing along that theme that I'll share is, at least in my experience working in the consulting business, is that it really helps to have an attitude of being flexible, perhaps not a generalist, but being willing to try more than one thing. It not only gives you a lot more interesting career opportunities and more interesting work environment. From a practical standpoint, the more connections you establish inside a firm, the more likely you will to survive the hard times that invariably come in any profession. There's up times and down times. And so being flexible, willing to take on new assignments, different technical areas, and broaden your horizon is a valuable trait to have.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So we often hear about the sort of disconnect between management and implementation and the science that's going on at the universities. And I know that American Water Resources Association is one way that you as professionals keep up on the science that's coming out. But can you give us some sort of questions or problems that you face as professionals that need to be addressed by the science? For students that are going to go on for their master's or PhDs, what's an area of research that there's a question or where there's a hole?
Just generally, you hear a lot about best available science. It's our job to determine what's best and what's available and what's science. And so you need the fundamentals in order to do that. You can't fake it, and this is in no way disparaging of a general education, but really, we do science. It's our job to bring the facts forward and hopefully let them rule the day, be what persuades people. But, it's a mix. As in any social interaction, you've got to, understand other people's perspectives and present the information in a way that they can actually use it. But science is first and foremost. If you don't know what you're dealing with, then, the chances of you're providing a a useful and accurate recommendation that goes way down. And that's what, we're only as good as our recommendations and the science that underlies that.
An interesting trend I'm seeing is a concept, it's got various terms, total water management. When I first started, the focus was on end-of-pipe discharges. What was that particular stretch of stream or that particular county, what were their problems? And about in the 80s, it suddenly became, people realized that, hey, water is organized on a basin level, and let's go to a water basin level to try and solve water problems. What I've seen emerging in the last few years, and I think is going to be a pretty big guiding principle in future years, is this idea that it's not just, say, stormwater runoff, it's not just wastewater discharges or the need for additional water supplies. They all interact, and by working them together in an integrated fashion, you can perhaps stretch a water supply that's run out of options by managing your stormwater more effectively and more intelligently. And so this idea of total water management and this decision science is an emerging trend that I think is going to help the field.
Yeah, I would echo that too with the just integrating land use more and understanding how the development that we do and the changes that we do on the land, how that affects the water resources. That's a huge issue that we just really haven't been able to manage very effectively from, I think, a sort of management policy and law perspective. So, you know, any technical work that can help decision makers, you know, see the big picture and see the different range of options, I think will be really crucial, especially with the new charge to restore the Puget Sound by 2020. So.
I think we're out of time.
Yeah, I think we're out.
Thank you.